As you can hear, my throat's a little dry this morning. I was on the phone quite a bit last night and then again early this morning, so I can put up with it, so can you. Exodus 8 and 8, the 8th chapter and the 8th verse. Before we get into the actual firstborn again, I want to share with you why we have to continue to push at this and keep the pressure on Pharaoh. I want to tell you why you don't come here and find messages that just send you out of here just feeling so good and don't stir you up, because Pharaoh doesn't really respond well to anything other than pressure. And I'm going to share with you how it's important to have an intercessor in order to entreat for you for the Lord. And I can prove that because you've been trying it yourself all your life and you're no closer now than you were then. Exodus 8:8. It says, then Pharaoh called 442-7677 and said, entreat the Lord. Oh, wait a minute. Wait. Well, in the Bible it says, and Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron. But see, I'm too smart for you. You know that Moses and Aaron are in heaven. And you may have a long-distance phone, but it's not that long. There's no way that you can call Moses and Aaron, so you think you're off the hook. Well, let me tell you what it's going to take, child, for you to get out of this pressure. Pharaoh called 442-7677 and said, entreat the Lord that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may do sacrifice unto the Lord. First of all, Pharaoh's a liar. That's number one. So whenever Pharaoh called 442-7677 and asked me to entreat the Lord and take away the frogs, I always know what to come back with. See, I need to know whether it's you or Pharaoh. And the way that I have to do it is in verse 9. And 442-7677 said unto Pharaoh, glory over me, when shall I entreat for thee? I'm going to say that again. And 442-7677, and look, Moses had the nerve to put his name in there. I'm not even doing that. I'm just putting a number in there. So don't get on my case, will you? And 442-7677 said unto Pharaoh, glory over me, when shall I entreat for thee? When do you want this thing done? And this is an important question, because the word entreat means to intercede and to make prayer. Intercede means to make a request in behalf of another. When do you want me to talk to Jesus on your behalf? Oh, well, it's not me, it's that wife of mine. No. When do you want me to talk to Jesus on your behalf? Well, as soon as we get to that point, all of a sudden it starts getting fuzzy. Intercede also means to intervene for the purpose of producing agreement. You have no agreement with your wife because you have no agreement with me because you have no agreement with Jesus. That's your problem. You have no agreement with your husband because you have no agreement with me. You have no agreement with Jesus, and therefore there is no agreement. You have no agreement with your own body. You can't even tell yourself no. Because you have no agreement with your husband, because he has no agreement with me, because there is no agreement with Jesus. So you see, there has to be this intervention is for the purpose of producing agreement. And Jesus said, we're all sinners. And until I can get you to agree with that part, we're going nowhere. Now, that's what has to happen, but the question is, when do you want me to intercede? When means on what occasion, under what circumstances, and at what point? In other words, what has to be happening in your life before you'll actually ask me to intercede? And what if Pharaoh said, tomorrow? I did not ask you what time. I said, when? On what occasion, under what circumstances, how bad does it have to get? And all he said in verse 10, tomorrow. tomorrow means to defer something till a later time. It means to put off to a future time, to postpone. So you see, the Lord is wise to you, and so am I. Some of you call 442-7677 just to see when you can talk, and I say, when do you want to talk? Tomorrow. Call you back and let you know when. Things aren't tough enough for you, are they? Tomorrow also means to delay. It means to defer and to delay. It also means to give in to the wish of another. You're deferring to Pharaoh. That's why you're putting it off. You forget that Jesus said, today, if you will hear his voice. And your answer is always, tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll do it, tomorrow we'll do it, tomorrow we'll do it. Well, you see, God is smart, and he knows what's going to happen when you put it off till tomorrow. In fact, he told Moses ahead of time what was going to happen. Ladies, watch this. Don't give your kids until tomorrow. Stay with it today. Don't stay with empty promises that you get from one another. If it isn't today, he or she is lying. I want you to know that right now. Because Pharaoh's always looking for a little room, a little space. Look at verse 15. Moses went out and did his thing, and the frogs were gone. It says, but when Pharaoh saw that there was respite, he hardened his heart and hearkened not unto them as the Lord had said. I can't tell you how many times people have come and I've counseled with them, and we've started this process, and they hug each other and kiss each other, but forget there's still no agreement with the Lord. Just temporary respite. But I'm going to tell you something, ladies. I'm going to tell you something, men. Temporary respite will only cause the Pharaoh in you to harden his heart again. Respite means a little relief, a little breathing room, a little room, a little space. That's all he's looking for. Just a little space to continue his work from the darkness. A little relief, a little respite. Forgive me, I want to do better. I agree with that. But when do you want me to entreat? Tomorrow. Give me a little relief right now. Throw a little more money in the basket, sing a little louder, pray a little longer, read a little more. It's not going to do it. You're looking for relief. But look who you're looking for relief for. See, the Word of God is pressuring that Pharaoh in you, that wrong training, and you're looking for relief for it. I'm telling you who you love. I'll tell you something else. You'll find no relief, no room, no space, and no breathing room, Ken. Here, Pharaoh, there's no room for you here. You see, because 442-7677 knows relief will cause you to say tomorrow. And we need to hear today. And I'm only telling you, some of you who give relief to Pharaoh, whether you do it to the Pharaoh and you or the Pharaoh and your mate, you're fighting what's going on from this pulpit. The enemy is using you to keep itself alive and to keep this thing fresh down in the cellar like the mushroom that it is. And it's a poisonous one, and it's going to kill your marriage. It's going to kill your health. And ultimately, it's going to kill you. Now, the problem with Pharaoh is he's passionate. And passion only knows pressure. It doesn't know anything else. So you see, now it's pressure time for passion time. Or pressure for the firstborn of Pharaoh. And I said all of this only to tell you and to make you to understand that I have no personal axe to grind with you. But as long as you're saying tomorrow, then the Lord's going to keep preaching it today. Now, if you're tired of hearing it, then all you have to do is say today, and we can move on. But until that happens, it'll be today. And we'll continue dealing with the firstborn. Now that you know that the battle lines are drawn and what they are, let's go to work. Exodus 11:4. The firstborn of Pharaoh has got to go. And Moses said, Thus saith the Lord, about midnight will I go out into the midst of Egypt. Now remember what midnight meant. That's when it gets as bad as it can get. And at that point in time, you know, none of you, when your lives get as bad as they can get, none of you are theological geniuses. You know that? Boy, my phone will ring at 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, 5. It doesn't matter about midnight. But the minute there's a little breathing room, then you're off, gone. All of a sudden you get this intellectual capacity. And you're off and you can figure everything out for yourself. So about midnight, God says, I'm going to go out in the midst of Egypt. And here's what's going to happen, verse 5. And all the firstborn of the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon his throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant that is behind the mill, and all the firstborn of beasts. In other words, everything that's firstborn is going to die. Now, firstborn means everything that's first in importance, first in quality. In other words, let's put it this way. Everything you put in front of Jesus is about ready to die. That's your firstborn. If you remember, firstborn from the Hebrew meant that you make first. It means that you give the birthright to. In other words, when you were born in your family, your parents gave you a birthright. Their eyes, some of you to one degree or another, didn't make out too good there. Their hair, their skin color, everything. They gave you a lot of physical birthrights. And we can really tell pretty much where you come from because you're as ugly as your mama. It's pretty hard for you to deny one another if I can get you in the same room. But you see, there's another firstborn birthright that you inherited from them. All their habits, all their training, all of their principles, and all of their beliefs. And inevitably there comes a time when those principles and those beliefs are going to butt heads with the truth. And when they do, the one that comes out first is your birthright. And if you come out of it acting like your mom and your dad, you're acting like Pharaoh. See, the firstborn is the one that receives the birthright. And we're going to deal with two birthrights that you have today. The one that you got from your parents and the birthright you received when you were born again. Sad to say, you all have the birthright of Jesus, but very few of you are enjoying. Most of you are still dealing with the birthright from the parents. I talked to a man the other day and he said, I've given my life to Jesus. I said, so has every other Christian, brother. And I thank God for that. But you know what Jesus said? Now that you've given me your life, which is admittedly a mess, guess what? He said, I want to give you my life. I don't know a Christian yet that isn't willing to give his life to Jesus. But finding the ones that are willing to accept Jesus' life for them, therein lies the difficulty. And that's what this is all about. It's you've either got your life or you've got the life of Jesus. You either have Pharaoh or you've got the Lord. Now, this firstborn is what you make first. First, if you remember, means that precedes all others, that's before all others. And with most people, the first one in your life is you. And anybody that doesn't deal with your passion, your temperament, and your disposition comes second best because you have to be first. After all, you are the firstborn of Pharaoh. And one of the first characteristics of the firstborn of Pharaoh is we have this mentality to be first. Now, the firstborn of Jesus Christ has a mentality to be last, and then God makes you first. But the firstborn of Pharaoh has to be first. They have to be first in line. They have to be first in everything. They can come behind in nothing They have to precede all others, and they have to be before all others. They have to be foremost in rank, foremost in quality, and foremost in importance. And you see, the way they got this way is because they received the birthright of Pharaoh. They're the firstborn of Pharaoh. The firstborn gets the birthright. Birthright means the right or rights that a person has because he was born into a certain family. Now, you might as well understand this right now. You look like your mama and dad, and you act like your mama and dad. That's your birthright. Now, when you start acting like Jesus Christ, you will have changed birthrights. You would have given up your life and received the life of Christ. See, God doesn't want to take anything away from you. He wants to make a trade. The problem is that if you take Jesus as your birthright, you can't be first anymore. And yet, if you do, you will be first. You just can't make yourself first anymore. So you see, the birthright is what you have by virtue of the family that you're born into. Now, I know your soul is born into the family of God. I'm not preaching to souls here today. I'm preaching to your bodies which have those dirty habits yet. Your soul didn't open that refrigerator more times than it should have, and your soul didn't drink that stuff, and your soul didn't snort it. You did. And the sad fact of the matter is, if most of the people in this room opened up their refrigerator as often as they open up their Bible, I'd be alone probably in this room this morning. You'd all be dead. You don't understand that you have to feed the child in order for it to grow. And all you do is you keep feeding the wrong side. You don't want to hear the word. That's why you won't call 442-7677. You want to call mom and dad because they'll tell you what you want to hear. So see, this birthright is the one that came because of the family that you were born into. Now let me tell you, it's the firstborn of Pharaoh that's the problem here. And Pharaoh, if you remember, meant king. And king, K-I-N-G, comes from the word kin. So the word king means the head of a kin. In other words, it's a relative that you've crowned. And that kin becomes an absolute monarch and a supreme ruler in your life. And listen, there's no room for a king and a lord. You're going to have to give up one or the other. Now, how do you know whose kin you are? Well, the word kin means relatives, family, and family relationship. But it also means something else. It means kindred as by blood. So you can tell who your kin is by the blood. Now, obviously, those of us who are Christians have access to the blood of Christ. And if you were kin to Jesus by blood, you'd act differently. The fact of the matter is, you're still kin to your mom and dad. Because the word blood means the following. And this will tell you who you're kin of. Blood means the relationship by parental heritage, which means like father, like son. As the mother is, so is the daughter. That's your blood relation. But it also means relationship by passion, temperament, and disposition. So if your passion, temperament, and disposition is like your parents, then you have a kin for a king, and that's Pharaoh. If you act like mom and dad and you're more worried about what they think than what the word says, then you have a kin for a king. And your passion and your temperament and your disposition are the firstborn of Pharaoh. You're going to act just like him. And that's why you don't like these messages, by the way, because the Pharaoh in you doesn't want to lose control. So if you act like mom and dad, you have a king. If you act like Jesus, you have a Lord. That's as simple as it gets. Now I want to share with you how you can know which one you are. firstborn or blood kin has three connotations. Number one, it means passion, temperament, and disposition. The first characteristic of the firstborn of Pharaoh is passion. The first thing right off the bat you can tell if you're still serving Pharaoh is whether you have passion. And passion, the first definition of the word, is the suffering or agony of a martyr. Now, as we covered before, martyrs are people that are suffering without fault. These are people that have the problems, but it's somebody else's fault. Now, they are suffering. They do have all the bad habits to show it, but it's not their fault. The first sign of Pharaoh's firstborn is when I run into a martyr. The one that has difficulty dealing with the fact that his suffering or her suffering is because of their doing, not mine and not anybody else's. This is the kind of individual who ultimately will even blame God. I've done and said everything that's required, and yet I'm still suffering. So not only am I suffering for the sins of all the people, my wife, my husband, but I'm also suffering for the shortcomings of God. Because I've done everything that I've been told and I'm still suffering. I'll tell you, it's bad enough when you want to be a martyr for another sinner. But when you try to save Jesus Christ, you're in a whole lot of trouble. Now let me tell you something. If you still have suffering and agony, it's because you are a martyr. You have passion. Now those of you that have been in this church for any length of time know how I feel because of what I've learned about emotions, what we call passions or emotions. They're killers. Now, when you're a very young child, you get the candy of the emotion. But when you grow older, then you get the other side of it. I'm going to share with you what passion really means. And if you got the first part, you're going to have the second part. The word passion, besides suffering of a martyr, basically has 12 more definitions. It means any of the emotions. And you're going to find out this morning they're sequential. Once you get into passion, you're on for the ride. You start in love, and the only way you can get off is in hate, a wish to avoid at the end, and you got to go through all of them. There's no way out of passion except to finish it. And then you start it all over again because you're stubborn. Now let me tell you how this passion thing works. I will give you the 12 definitions and I will show you how they work sequentially. The first definition of the word passion is love. Now on the surface that sounds good, but this is another word for lust. It's erotic love. Jesus will give you agape love. And later on this evening or tonight, we're going to find out about the temper or the passion of Jesus Christ, agape love. But right now we're talking about your mama and daddy's love. This is the grabby, touchy, I want to feel good kind of love. Now admit it. When you grab a hold of your child and give her that warm squeeze and hug, and you're touching and fawning all over each other and licking your head, it feels good. Don't tell me it doesn't, because I don't see you doing it with anybody else's kids. You just fawn all over your own. Why? Because you're getting a sexual gratification out of it. It's the wrong kind of love. It's not agape love. When's the last time Jesus ever grabbed a hold of you that way and gave you that good feeling and won in return? I know there are some churches that teach that, but you don't get that here. Agape love is what Christ is all about, not this emotional, mushy, touchy, let's grab each other kind of love. I'm going to read 12 words, and then I'm going to define them to you, so you'll know what happens when you get into this grabby, touchy feeling, emotional love that you were imprinted with as a child. The definition goes as follows: love, joy, enthusiasm, fondness, strong love or affection, and desire. Well, what's wrong with that? We're not done yet. Fear, grief, great anger, rage, fury, and hate. That's what's wrong with it. It's the whole range of emotions. And why do you think the people who get into this thing are the ones that love their wives and husbands the most? They do everything for them when they're on the upside of emotion. But when they get on the other side and they have to, they're the ones that throw pots and pans at each other. And then you love to make up afterwards because then you get on the other side of emotion. You don't understand. You're on a merry-go-round. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to you if it hasn't already. The individual that gets caught up in this kind of merry-go-round is forever attracted to someone of the opposite sex who takes them through the wide range, the full range of those emotions. You will forever be looking for someone who can make you feel good on the one side, all this emotional, touching, sexual connotation of the love. But before it's over, that's the one you'll fight with the most. And the things they do, when they did the positive things, you loved them. It made you feel great. But they're human beings. And one day they're going to say something you don't like, and that puts you in the pits. And now you get into grief and fear and anger and rage and fury and ultimately hate. And that's when you call 442-7677, and I say, when? You say, tomorrow. Well, by tomorrow, hunger is going to make you two fall in love again. But you see, what happens the minute all those physical desires are satisfied? Well, then you start looking at all the faults of the individual. And why would one do that? I'm going to tell you how this works. You get hooked first with love. And love means a deep feeling of attachment and devotion to a person. It doesn't matter what person it is. It starts out with your parents. Then you grow, it becomes friends. You get this personal devotion and attachment to a human being. And when that human being won't play the way you want to play, that's when you go tell mom and say, Johnny's being mean to me. So what do? You snap them up and you make up the difference for them to keep them into that thing. They've got to have a feeling of attachment and devotion to a person. Now let me tell you what's wrong with devotion. It comes from the word devote, which means you have no say in the matter anymore. You done lost your vote. You've been devoted. Now all you have to do is get devoted to a person and you have no say in the matter anymore. When that person's up, you're up, and when that person's down, you're down, and you have no say in the matter. None. So does it do you any good to call 442-7677 and I tell you, you have to become undevoted to that. You have to kick that firstborn of Pharaoh because you have no vote in the matter. You're into love and attachment. And it's love and attachment to a person rather than the Lord Jesus Christ. I've seen it more often than once. The minute that Pharaoh mentality is flushed out, the husband or the wife, either one, the minute your husband or your wife says, I've had it, I'm leaving, then all of a sudden, there's a change. But the minute there's respite, then they harden their heart again, and we're off to the races again. And once in a while, that individual will actually leave. And what do? You find someone to replace them to get back into love again. You want to be devoted to an individual. And it's amazing to me that the right side of you knows when you come to church that don't get devoted to a man. Watch it. Well, I'm in agreement with that. But why do you stop with me? I want mom and dad to join that club. You're already in agreement with me when it comes to this man. But when it comes to your mom and dad, it's a horse of a different color, isn't it? When it comes to you, you're devoted to yourself. And the individual that's devoted to another person needs another person devoted to them. Because you can't have that touchy-feely kind of feeling that you want from the Lord that you need from somebody else. You've been taught love is wrong. You've been taught the wrong kind of love. Now this evening, I'm going to share with you where that love belongs. I didn't say that love was wrong. You put it in the wrong place. This love belongs in the marriage bed. There and only there. The difficulty is you're using it everywhere else, and it would come time to the marriage bed, all you got is agape left. And I'm telling you, agape love doesn't work too good in the marriage bed. But you see, your emotional love is with the refrigerator, with your alcohol, with all of your temperaments, with all of these. That's where your emotional love goes. And somehow or other, when you get to the marriage bed, you think something's wrong with you. Yes, there is something wrong with you. There's no emotional love there. It's been dissipated on everything else because of your wrong training. You see, it isn't that the love is wrong, it's misapplied. You have to have a job that makes you feel good. If the boss says something that doesn't make you feel good, you're unhappy. All of this emotional love, you dissipate it all over creation. You turn it on your kids, you turn it on yourself, you turn it on everybody. And then after a while, you find out that the marriage bed, the sexual side, the physical side of your relationship is wanting seriously. And what do you think? Well, he or she is interested in someone else. No. That may be the case eventually, but that's not the way it starts. The fact of the matter is, you are trying to use agape love in the bed. Why? Because your emotional love, this proper kind of love that belongs between a husband and a wife, is everywhere else but where it belongs. So they see this deep feeling of attachment and devotion to a person right then and there tells you you're heading in the wrong direction. Now, if you can confine that deep feeling of devotion, that deep feeling of attachment to your husband or your wife, then you would use the agape everywhere else, and you wouldn't be attached that way to everybody in creation. I know people who actually get depressed because of what's happening on Dallas. I know people that when they, listen guys, some of you know this, you get home and your wife's in a bad mood, maybe you didn't get home right exactly when you should have, I'll tell you what happened. JR's been doing something on TV and they watched him and she's identifying. She's into it. She's emotionally hooked to it. She's emotionally hooked to everything. So this deep feeling of attachment and devotion to a person is that erotic, Cupid, God of love kind of thing. And the difficulty with it is it becomes more than one person, then it becomes things as well. You need more money, you need a better car, you need a newer this, you need somebody else get something, you gotta have it too. Because it gives you a feeling of satisfaction, gratification, you're having a sexual relationship with everything. Because when they get something and you don't, you feel down. And when you get it, you feel good. You know what the Bible calls that? It says you're a whoremonger when you do that. You have to follow and chase things to make you feel good. And incidentally, you have to pay for all of them, don't you? Now, some people will say, well, I'm happily married and I stay at home. I've never been down there. Oh, no. You buy toys every day and you get your satisfaction. You get your kicks out of your toys. And you had to buy them. You're a whoremonger. You love things. You're devoted to people and things. It's the wrong kind of love. Now, if you took that love and put it where it belonged, then you would only have agape love for your toys. You could use them instead of having them use you. But you see, this love starts out looking good. Some would say, well, what's wrong with a deep feeling and attachment and devotion to a person? I'll tell you what's wrong. It causes joy. And joy means a very glad feeling, happiness and delight, which is equivalent to what drugs and alcohol and food does, isn't it? You get a deep attachment and devotion to a thing, and it does give you a very glad feeling. Until you look in the mirror, So you see, this love kind of attachment, if it isn't to the right thing and the right person, will give you joy, a very glad feeling, very much happiness and delight. Still, it would appear that that's not such a bad thing. But you see, that's the way it is with every bad habit. It looks good to begin with. It feels good to begin with. It tastes good to begin with. But we ain't got to the end of it yet. From love, you'll go to joy, the very glad feeling, and joy turns into enthusiasm. Now, some would say, well, isn't enthusiasm a good thing? I'll let you judge. You look it up. If you have a dictionary, if you can read and you have a dictionary, look up enthusiasm. Enthusiasm means to be inspired or possessed by a god. It means supernatural inspiration or possession. Enthusiasm means intense, eager interest. You see, the devotion to your cigarette gave you a glad feeling. Now you've got an intense, eager interest. You're starting to get hooked, aren't you? You're not hooked yet. See, we got fondness coming yet. And even fondness doesn't hook you, but you're getting there. This very glad feeling, this happiness, this delight that it gives you turns into enthusiasm. It becomes an intense, eager interest. It starts occupying more and more of your mind. It starts occupying more and more of your time. It's becoming an overriding, abiding thing in your mind. Why? It was love, joy, and now it's enthusiasm. You realize you're possessed. Your thoughts are possessing you, and they're always thoughts of the person you're devoted to or the thing you're devoted to. You're committing spiritual adultery in your mind. Suffice to say, now you're enthusiastic. You now have an intense, eager interest in that thing or that person that you're devoted to. Enthusiasm is followed quickly by fondness. Fondness means, and this is the way Mama taught it to us, tender, affectionate love. Well, let me tell you what else it means. See, Mom, you didn't read the whole definition when you told me this. You that are mothers here, you didn't tell your kids the whole definition. Why? Because you didn't know it. Well, you know it now. Fondness starts with tender, affectionate love. But if you get your dictionary, it also means to be foolish and insane. It means idiotic and imbecile. Doting. In other words, when I see you whacking after your kids and your grandkids, fawning all over them and doting on their every word, you're acting like an idiot. You're an imbecile. That's fondness. Now, you call it tender, affectionate love, and it is. But it also means foolish, insane, and idiotic. It also means foolishly naive or hopeful. I've watched and listened to some of your kids, and I have no problem with the children. I don't. But listen, when I watch your kids and I listen to them sing, believe me, we don't hear the same thing. You're foolishly hopeful and naive. If it was up to you, they'd be at Carnegie Hall right now. If it was up to me, they'd be singing in the toilet. You're foolishly naive. You think your kids are geniuses. You don't see them the way they are. Why? Because you're an imbecile. You're fond of them. Why? Because you're enthusiastic about them. Why? Because they give you a very glad feeling. They give you joy. I can almost stand, I can sit back here and watch and not know I know who's singing if the parents are out there. I mean, you look like a jack-o'-lantern now with that grin. I know who the mama is and I know who the daddy is. And when they're doing something that's good, boy, your eyes are just glued on them. Oh, that's mama. That's grandma. That's dad. But then I watch your kids when they're jumping all over the place and messing up, and you're looking everywhere but there. That's idiotic and imbecile. I know who you are. So you see, this love turns to joy, turns to enthusiasm, and now you're fond. Now you're foolishly naive about that thing you're devoted to. Oh, yes, I'll quit one day. And yes, I know just about everybody gets emphysema from those things, but I'll be different. And I'll quit before that happens. You become foolishly naive. Why? Because you've become fond of it. You're an idiot. You know what's wrong with that habit, and you still keep doing it. You chase that whore that you have to pay good money for to get a temporary good feeling. It's a harlot that you're chasing. It's something you have to pay for to get yourself a good feeling, when in reality, the Lord would provide that thing in the proper way if you'd allow him to. But what is it? You love everything wrong. And now your fondness is working against you. You now have tender, affectionate love. You're foolish and insane. You're idiotic and imbecile, doting on your kids and on yourself, by the way. You become foolishly naive or hopeful. You haven't straightened out your life as long as you've been on this earth, and you think somehow time is going to do for you in the future what time didn't do for you in the past. You're an idiot. But you are fond of yourself. There's no question about that. Now again, I'm going to share with you that all these qualities, when we look at the birthright of Jesus Christ at tonight's service, I'm going to show you how you can use all these feelings to your advantage rather than your disadvantage. Nowhere have I said these are wrong feelings. I said they're being misapplied. You're not supposed to turn these things off. Put them where they belong. Wish I had more time. We're running over, but we'll stop right here. Suffice to say that at 5 minutes after 11, the last thing the preacher had to say, let's stop where you are right now. You're an idiot. Let's stop in fondness. We'll pick it up here. Hopefully we'll get through this by 12 o'clock, and then we can go on to make you feel a little better this evening. But right now, I'll leave you where I found you. Insane. Brother Duane, would you close us up? The firstborn of Pharaoh is the target for the messages all day today. Exodus 11:5 says, "And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon his throne." Now, for purposes of this morning's message, we'll continue. As if you remember, the firstborn meant Pharaoh's passion, Pharaoh's temperament, and Pharaoh's disposition. Pharaoh being that relative of yours that taught you as a child how to act the way that you do. So it's that passion of your relative, that training that we're dealing with this morning. If you remember, the word passion meant the suffering or agony of a martyr. That's the person that told you all your life, and I don't need to know who it is, you know. The one that told you that they gave you the best years of their lives and that they made sacrifices for you. The one that told you that if it hadn't been for you coming along, they would have been in Hollywood. Yes. Famous. Who knows, you know, may have been at the UN by now. But they gave up so much for you. They gave you so much. Then they spend the rest of their lives trying to collect. So it's this martyr that really is nothing more than a terrorist. They're holding you hostage and they want to collect. So you see, this individual passed on to you the desire to give with something in return. You need something from everything you do. That's why you need cigarettes so bad. They give you something. Or alcohol or drugs or passion, whatever it is. It's got to give you something back or it's no good. Anything that you do that just benefits someone else, you're not interested in. See, you have to be the martyr. You have to give something to get something in return. And what do you like? Suffering and agony. See, martyrs are stupid people. But martyrdom or passion has one other condition, one other manifestation that you need to know of. By definition, passion means the condition of being acted upon by an outside influence. The passionate, temperamental, emotional person is the one that their behavior depends on what's going on around them.
They're in bondage. They're slaves to whatever goes on around them. So whenever the circumstances are good, by definition, they're good. And when the circumstances, by definition, are not good, then they're not good. So you see what they are. They're slaves. Why? Because they're devoted to people and things. So when people and things are acting a certain way, they react to people and things. Now, when you come and tell me that your wife acted a certain way, and this is the way you reacted, then all you're saying is she acted this way, and then I did it again. I reacted. See, the individual that reacts is no better than the one that acted. You're stupid, both of you. One idiot leading another one. And for you to find fault in the other individual's actions isn't going to help you if you don't deal with your reaction. In other words, you redo the thing that you say you don't like. He or she said or did this, and you do the same thing, and don't see that you're in the same bondage. So you see, this condition of being acted upon by outside influence is the passion. When you can learn that it doesn't matter what people say or think about you, you will have arrived. I've said it so many times, you can sit there and say, Reuben is the dumbest person, the biggest idiot I've ever met. Listen. If that's true, I was an idiot and the dumbest person before you said it. So I don't care what you say. If I'm dumb and stupid, I was stupid long before you knew it. So see, you don't influence me, no matter what you say. And listen, if I'm not dumb and stupid, then you can say it till you're purple. It's not going to make it a reality. You cannot influence me by the way you think or talk. See, I understand what I am and who I am. And I understand there's only one person that can do anything about it. And for me to react to your action makes me as stupid as you are. And that's why you don't like me. Because we're not alike. And I've said this before, I love everybody in here, but I don't like most of you. And I thank God for that. Because if I did, he'd have to put someone up here that didn't like you. Because how could someone with the same problem, not having found an answer for it, show you an answer to something he doesn't know? So I can't like you. I can't be like you. I don't have that luxury or that curse, whichever way you want to look at it. Now, what is this outside influence that makes us act the way that we do? Well, again, we'll review very quickly. Love. It starts with love. Wrong love. Love, again, is that deep feeling of attachment and devotion to a person or a thing. That's that outside influence that you need in order to feel good. Isn't it stupid? What are you going to do if Juan Valdez dies in Colombia? What are you going to do in the morning when you wake up? Got to have your coffee. See, you're devoted to a thing and a person, Juan Valdez in Colombia. Now they want us to believe that this poor guy all by himself with a jackass at his side picks enough coffee beans to feed all of your habits. That's crazy. Juan Valdez. The jackass isn't the one beside him, it's the one that believed that. So you see, this deep feeling of attachment and devotion to a person and to things makes you act like an idiot. It is amazing to me how people can wake up in the morning and literally can't do anything until they get a fix. You walk and grope to the coffee maker. And some of you have to have a cigarette before you wake up. You've got to burn something and inhale the fumes of trash that's burning. Fermented leaves. Go out in the back and well, we don't have those anymore. Remember, there used to be ash pit. Go to the dump. They burn that stuff all day long. You can sit there and inhale to your heart's content, and it's free. But see, it's this love, this feeling of attachment and devotion to things makes you act dumb. I am convinced that if they put a fence around the trash dump and charged you to go in there and inhale the fumes, some of you would go. You have to pay for your kicks. That's the whoredom. Something that makes you feel good that you got to pay for. See, Satan is smart. If he made him free, nobody would want him. Because you see, grace, a free gift, requires that you understand you don't deserve it. And see, those things that you can buy, you deserve, don't you? You worked hard for them. You deserve them. Love, if it stayed there, wouldn't be so bad. But as I said before, it turns to joy. The next definition is joy. So that person or thing that gives you joy, a very glad feeling, happiness and delight, gives you a fix, doesn't it? Well, I'm telling you, I don't care if it's a cigarette, drugs, another person, whatever gets you up will get you down. There's a hangover behind all of those glad feelings of happiness. All that joy has a downside. It has a hangover. Now, from love, you'll go to joy, and that'll turn to enthusiasm. That middle part of the word enthusiasm comes from the word theo, where it's where we get our word theocracy. And theo means God. Little g, it doesn't necessarily mean Jehovah God. It just means someone who's in authority and power. So enthusiasm means to be inspired or possessed by a God. Well, what do you mean inspired? I just smoke cigarettes. Well, expire means to breathe out, and inspire means to breathe in. Oh, well, I don't smoke. It doesn't matter how you do it. Once you take it in, you're inspired. And whatever you inspire, you will expire. That's why I appreciate it if you look the other way when you're talking to me. I'll get it, bounce it off the wall. You see, whatever you talk about will tell you what's inside. And there's more than one way to have bad breath, believe me. Now, this enthusiasm by this person or this thing that you'd get devoted to, and incidentally, this is the firstborn of Pharaoh. God doesn't do anything to you that compels this way. You can come here and you can be indifferent to me and to the Lord, and he won't do a thing. He doesn't devote you. He doesn't say, you have to come to church or I'll zap you with the lightning. All of you are here for various reasons, but none of you are here under the pressure of God. He doesn't take your right to make your own decisions away. And also, when you get here, he's not going to give you a very glad feeling and happiness and delight. He's not a joint. He's not a fix. He's not a cigarette. He's coming. You're here to learn something about yourself that you need to know. He also, from joy, doesn't make you enthusiastic, give you an intense, eager interest. See, you have a free will in this place. And that's the difference between Pharaoh and Jesus Christ. Now remember, from enthusiasm, you go to fondness. I'm talking now about your addictions, how you got into them, and what it's going to take to get you out. You got to know what door you came in. From enthusiasm, you go to fondness. Once you develop an intense, eager interest in something, you'll become fond of it. And fondness, again, means tender, affectionate love, but it also means to be insane, idiotic, imbecile, and stupid, and doting. Stupid decisions that we make. Now, from fondness, from this tender, affectionate love, you're not hooked yet on whatever you're fond of, but the next one's going to get you. From fondness, you go to strong love or affection. The word strong means severe, physically powerful. That's when you've got to have it. You can't think of anything else until you take care of it. there's nothing else makes any sense to you in your mind. It has become physically powerful. It's no longer just a mental thing. It's no longer just a desire. It's not no longer something that just looks good to you. It is something that's in there now. It's tender, affectionate love that's become strong love and affection. It's physically powerful now. It'll cause you pain. You know that? And if you don't take care of it, you'll have withdrawal symptoms. You'll break out in the sweats. You'll lose control of all your openings. I mean, this is addiction. I know people that wake up to drink a cup of coffee so they can go back to sleep. Now that's when you're hooked. See, coffee's supposed to keep you awake. But when you're dead asleep, and you have to be woken up in order to have coffee to go back to sleep, you're hooked. That's physically powerful. Sometimes that physical power gets so strong and so all-consuming, and you can't do anything. Maybe because of circumstances, you can't take care of it physically, so you'll do it mentally. You'll dream, you'll fantasize. And in your mind, there'll be a certain amount of satisfaction. It's got you. It's consuming you. It's physically powerful. It's severe, too. Cuts you no slack whatsoever. You don't understand that when you walk in here, the Lord says, I set this before you. I set blessing and cursing, life and death. Then you choose the one you want. The things that you're hooked onto give you no choice. They don't ask you what you want to do. They tell you, and then you lie in your teeth to cover up for your firstborn. It's physically powerful. It's got you. And you think you know the way out. Listen, it's because of you that it went in. And now you have strong love or affection for it. And it makes you a severe individual. God help the person that just asks a question about that. You'll defend that to the hilt. Because now it's become strong love or affection. And let me tell you something. At that point in time, the love and affection of your wife and your children, or your husband and your children, will be secondary. You can't have strong love and affection for both. You should have it for your wife, but you've got it for your things. And that's why you think there's something wrong with the marriage bed. I'm telling you, there's something wrong with your head. You're crazy. You're an idiot. Drunk on love, attachment and devotion to a person or a thing. And now you have this strong affection, this physically powerful thing that's driving you. Now, where does that take you? To sexual desire. And I'll home in on the word desire. We'll deal with the word sexual in a minute. You think sexual just means the gratification between a man and a woman? It can be between a woman and a pizza. Between a man and a joint, a marijuana joint. It's gratification. It makes your body feel good. It'll turn you to desire. This physically powerful need will turn it into desire. And you already know the end result, but you're going to do it anyway. And if you look at your history, you've been doing it. And you'll even go seek it, and they've already told you in advance, I'm beat the hell out of you when it's over. Oh, that's all right. I love the feeling up until we get to that point. Now you have a desire. Desire means a craving. It means a coveting and wishing for something. But you see, if it stopped there with just wishing and coveting and desiring, it wouldn't have the effect. But I'll tell you where it goes. Desire means to ask for and to request. So see, whatever you're thinking and you're desiring, you're going to ask for it. And that's why I've got this little sign here. Whatever you got, you ask for it. Now, if you didn't ask for what's coming from this pulpit, then you've got what you asked for. But either way, you've got it. One of these days you will have had it, but right now you've got it. So you see what's happened here. You've gone from love to joy to enthusiasm to fondness to strong love, and now you are down to desire. Now you have a problem. Now that's all you talk about, and that's all you talk for. When you're around the people that agree with you, you talk for this desire. When you're around the people that you don't want them to know, you make lies about it and cover up for it. That's your desire. That's your sexual desire. That's where you're getting your gratification. That's where you're getting your glad feelings and your happiness and delight and your inspiration. That's where you get your intense, eager interest. You're no longer interested in home. You're no longer interested in being a spiritual head. You're no longer interested in being a parent. You're no longer interested in watching that child. You become interested in other things. Mom, you're in a trap. Dad, you're even worse. Now the things that you desire are all the wrong things. And every time a right person with a right request for a right desire gets in your face, you can't stand it. Because what it makes you aware of the fact that you're unable, incapable, and worse, unwilling to take care of the right desire. So what do? You blow smoke. You see, you can't desire the right and wrong. You're hooked on right or wrong. You cannot have both. Well, see, now you've gone in this emotional merry-go-round from love to desire. And you went by way of love and joy and enthusiasm and fondness, strong love and desire. Now, everybody, once you get to desire, Jesus said, whatever you ask for, you shall receive. We all get what we want, don't we? Every one of us. I don't care what you love. I don't care what you're inspired about. I don't care what it is. You're going to get it. And sooner or later, we all have what we said we loved and wanted. So one would think that would be the end of the problem. Emotion brings you what you wanted. The problem is you're not through with emotion yet. It doesn't stop at desire. It goes on. Love to joy, to enthusiasm, to fondness, to strong love and desire. But here comes number 7, fear. The minute you get what you wanted and you realize it doesn't fulfill, fear sets in. And then you start fearing, can I keep it? What if he finds someone else cute? You look in the mirror and say, put on a little here or there, lost a little here or there. His emotions are starting to go somewhere else and you are starting to worry about keeping it. Let me tell you the truth. You'd be better off without it. See, this desire for what you need, everybody's looking for what they think they need. But once you get it and you realize it didn't do the job, the next thing after desire is fear. It's only Jesus Christ, when you reach the truth and you understand who he is and what he does, there's no fear after that. You don't feel trapped. Fear means an ambush, a snare, and a trap. It amazes me, all you ladies, you run after a certain person, and finally you get him. The next thing I know, I feel trapped in this marriage. You're an idiot, that's why. And the man was even worse. He lied to you, told you how beautiful you were, and you really looked like his mama. Because that's what he was looking for. And listen, his mama is no prize package. Can't stand her anymore and he can stand you. You're going to get the same thing when it's over. But he lied to you. He followed you. He paid for the dinners. At least, ladies, you go along and it doesn't cost you anything. Man, we're stupid beyond belief. Not only do we pay to get in. Now, this part I don't like. I could call Acapulco right now, and there's 2 or 3 people down there sunning themselves on what I've paid them to get out of these traps. It amazes me, though. The preacher will charge you $50 to get in. Then some guy along will come after you're in that trap. It's going to cost you thousands and thousands and thousands. And I'm not so sure you ever get out of that. For the simple reason, you go and do it again. So see, fear is that feeling of being trapped. You're unhappy with it, you're unhappy without it. See, the problem is you're loving the wrong thing the wrong way. Now, there's nothing wrong with this kind of love if you keep it in the marriage bed. But you're too cool for that. A weekend here, a weekend there, here a little, there a little, everywhere a little. Old MacDonald had a farm. And after a while, it's an oink-oink here and an oink-oink there, isn't it? And sooner or later, that's exactly the way he'll talk to you. He'll think of you as a pig. And you'll deny it. Then you'll sit down at the dinner table with him and prove it. You overdo everything. You're emotionally involved with food. Let me tell you, let me just back off just a little bit right here for those of you that say, well, not me. When you sit down at that dinner table and you eat more than you need, you're having an emotional involvement and a whorish relationship with food. You eat and eat and eat and eat and eat spicy things that make you feel good, more than you need, wrong things. Why? Well, you love it. You love everything but the right thing. But it does become a trap, doesn't it? I had a friend of mine once. Was in the trap. As far as I know, she still is. Sit down to eat. That woman could eat the walls. She'd eat the wallpaper off your walls. Better make sure you had plenty of food. But at the end of every meal, she would ask for cottage cheese. And I would tell her, look, cottage cheese after the meal will not help you. Cottage cheese instead of the meal might do something. But see, it's a trap. Or they'll eat, 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 and then they'll run all over, do all kinds of exercise, and then they'll come home and eat again. It's a trap, isn't it? Fear also means anxiety. It's that trapped feeling, that what am I going to do kind of feeling. Time is slipping away. The things that I thought out, so then they set a different standard and say, well, I'll try it this way. It's the same. You're looking for devotion to a person or a thing. You're looking to be acted upon by an outside influence. You're not looking for anything inside of you to affect your environment. Instead, it's the other way around. This trap, the word fear means anxiety, pain, and dread. Now that you have it, your abiding concern is, how am I going to keep it? And then after a while, you say, well, I don't want it either. But I don't want anybody else to have it. That's when it really gets it. You can't stand the man anymore, but you don't want anybody else to have him either. So now you come to a parting of the way, so you take everything. Why? So he doesn't have any way to enjoy it. You're going to show him. Dread, fear. Somehow or other, you're going to feel better if they're feeling bad. You're still looking to be acted upon by an outside influence. You still love that person, wrong and perverted, but you still love them. You still have an emotional tie to that individual. Maybe after all this time, they were wrong and they're doing wrong, and you're still looking to placate their wrong and to make it look like it's right and please them and reward them for their wrong. You're still hooked. And you're hooked to the wrong thing, to a person and a thing. Now, this is the downside. We're starting on the downside of this emotional love now that your mama taught you was such a great thing. And it is in the marriage bed. When we get to that, you're going to find out you're wasting your time. I'm going to show you some things, men, that you could legitimately bring to the marriage bed, a box of firecrackers and some skyrockets. Instead, you bring your agape love there and you get emotional everywhere else. And women, you're no better. In fact, you're worse. Fear also means timidity and fright. Now, this thing that you've worked so hard to gain, now you become timid. You're afraid to lose it because you know as well as anybody that it has the power, he has the power, she has the power, it has the power to make you feel just as bad as it has power to make you feel good. And you're afraid of the withdrawal symptoms. You're hooked. Stupid hooked on stupid. Idiot hooked on idiot. And I know it's a feeling of anxiety and it's pain and it's dread and it's fright and apprehension I wonder how this is going to work. What am I going to do? How is this? I don't care. But let me tell you the last definition of the word fear. Once you receive this thing that you've got, fear means to suspect. Now all of a sudden, you're looking for skeletons behind every closet, behind every word. No matter what he did, I wonder what he's up to. I wonder, he must be doing this for that reason. She must be doing this for this reason. You're full of fear. And you're looking to be acted upon by an outside influence. You are hooked on a person or a thing or a combination, probably both. Now you start suspecting. Now you become Sherlock Holmes. You can figure everything out. And of course, the way you figure it out, you're right and everybody else is wrong. Now that puts you back to martyrdom, doesn't it? Everybody else is wrong and you're doing the suffering. This is a downside now of this love. This is about the time your children start growing up in that love that you gave them to lick their heads every day. Now all of a sudden they're trapped by it. Now they can't go out and have a decent time with somebody else because you suspect all their friends. Nobody's good enough for them. You want this for them and you want now you've got them trapped in a spider web, a black widow spider web. Your children feel trapped because the minute they leave, your nest is empty. Now you paid for them. You want them. Ain't nobody going to take them away from you. And they feel trapped. They're trying to get away from you. But there's a certain amount of devotion to you because you built them that way. So what do? They go out and marry one just like you. And they're still in the trap, aren't they? They're still in the same situation. And that individual that appreciated so much your doting concern and care now abhors it with everything that's in them. They're trapped. Oh, yes, I know how much you loved it when that man, when you were courting, opened the door for you and did everything, flowers and what have you. But now, if you spend more than 5 minutes in the bathroom, he suspects there's somebody in there with you. It's a trap now, isn't it? All of a sudden, you can do no right, and all that love turned into a trap now. You constantly have to be doing things to please his idiosyncrasies, to keep him happy. He needs his fix. And now the thing that started out good has become a trap. And it's the same for the man involved. See, he did all those things up front to impress you, to lie to you, so that you could say, I do. And the minute you say, I do, he doesn't. Why? Because he was lying to begin with. I've said it before and I'll say it again in front of the witness. I didn't before and I ain't going to now. I can't afford to be in that trap. See, we're free in Christ. And if I'm free in Christ, I can't have any slaves. I cannot have people that depend on me and what I do. We have a Lord for that. Now, I will help you in whatever the Lord wants to give you. Praise God, if it's through me, I'm more than happy. But don't look to me for it. I got nothing for you. Everything I've got is mine. I'll get some for you. But you keep your cotton-picking hands off of mine. I'm not into traps. Black widow spiders are. Black widows, there's some in this room. I can't seem to get off this subject. This trap thing has got me. We should have been past this a long time ago. You're spinning some webs, ma'am. Yes, you need a man. Yes, you need children. But you see, you need the man for one thing, to mate, and then you eat him. Get out of here. I got the children. That's all I need. Go rattle some pots. Go make some money. You've made it. That's it. Get out of here. Oh, I'll eat you. And the man, not knowing the stupidity of what he's into, he'll mate and then leave. He'll sit in front of the TV set and he'll do everything becomes more important. You're married to a black widow and you are a black spider also, by the way. And the black widow spider is larger than her mate. She looks good, too. spins the web, and poor dummy comes along and they mate, you better get out of there in a hurry, or you'll be the second course, chump. She can always get another one. And she will, by the way. She's got a trap mentality. Men mean nothing to her other than people to mate with and somebody to bring the money in. A weekend thrill, a couple years here and there, stay away from the children, I'll take care of everything. See you about midnight. That's that trap mentality. But I'm telling you, who's ultimately going to fall in their own trap? It's you. In fact, you're already in it. Because you're the one that's seeing the sands of time going by and your anxiety is building up. Because all of a sudden, all the black spiders are looking for younger black widows. And you see, your web don't move it too many anymore. The only thing you can catch is the ones that are caught up with arthritis now, you know? The fast ones are too, your web isn't as sticky as it used to be. And let me tell you, it's not going to get any better. And in order to entice, you have to give more and more and more and more until you've got nothing left to give. You're trapped. It's the same thing with alcohol or cigarettes. You ultimately have to give it everything you have. It literally will kill you. That's a trap. Every time you light that thing up, that's a black widow spider. It's eating you. Yes, I know it's giving you a temporary good feeling. It's going to eat you. But before it does, it wraps you in a web that you can't get out of. And boy, you need those things. You're trapped. And when you don't have them, you have anxiety and dread and fright and even pain and apprehension and concern. It's a trap. The Christian should never wake up and deal with the day where there's pain and anxiety. Because Christ doesn't give pain and anxiety. Your wrong emotional love does. But still, we're not through with it here. I wish I could tell you this was the end of it. We're on number 7. There's 12 of these babies. The next one is grief. The minute you feel trapped by fear, then grief comes. And grief means intense suffering caused by loss. I think the worst kind of loss is when he's not gone yet, but he's not there anymore. Still there, but he's not. She's still there, but she isn't. They're still there, but they're not. You've suffered the loss already. You're in grief right now. The things that you used to feel before, the things that you did before, they're not there anymore. You still have the same address, but everything else has been lost, hasn't it? You've gone from fear to grief. And this awareness of loss is going to take you to the next one, great anger. Fear to grief to great anger. Anger means distress and opposition. And it's opposition showing itself in a desire to fight back at the supposed cause. Now you're fighting with each other. Blaming one another. Blaming the Lord, blaming me, blame the boss, blame whatever you want. It's anger, it's an opposition, it's a desire to fight back instead of understanding how you got into this thing. Now, once you have great anger, a desire to fight back, you're not quit yet. Number 10 is rage. Now you have the desire to fight back, so you've got rage. Rage means uncontrollable anger. It means to be mad and rabid like a dog. It means insanity. In other words, your mind's about ready to blow up. You haven't done anything yet. That's coming. But now you have great rage. You're suffering from insanity. Uncontrollable anger, rage, means insanity. From insanity, you go to the next to the last one. Fury. And fury means a fit of violence. That's when you actually do the thing. You take the action. That's when you decide to start over again what you said you were going to quit. That's when you decide to tell the lie, to cover the other lie. That's when you decide to slap each other, whatever you do, however it manifests, you now have a fit of violence, a fury. But there's three of these babies. If you look up in the dictionary, look up the word fury, and you'll find a fit of violence, but it'll say, see the furies, plural. Now, these furies are the ones that we need to be concerned with, because it goes back to mama again and that female spirit that taught you how to get emotional over everything. The furies means three terrible female spirits with snake-like hair who punish the doers of unavenged crimes. Did you hear what he said? Well, what do you think about that? I don't care what you think about that. The Lord knows what I've done, and he knows what you've done, and he said, vengeance is mine. Why are you trying to punish everybody in the world, fury? The three terrible female spirits, they've taken over your body, that's one. They've taken over your soul, that's two. And they've taken over your spirit, that's three. That's when you act like a jerk. Jesus doesn't act that way. You don't find Jesus doing that. You've got three terrible female spirits in you. They're called furies. And you know, I found out these three women have a name. Three names. I haven't had time to look up what they mean, but I'll tell you what they are, and I suspect one of them. Fury number one is named Alecto. Number three is named Megara. Number two I like, Tissiphone. Or Tissiphone. Or Tissiphone. I'm homing in on the phone part. And remember, phone means the medium between. They just have to be in between everything. They have to find out the bad news, and they have to be the one that spreads it. And of course, they give their rendition of what's happened. And what do? They're avenging, they're the avenging furies, aren't they? They're the ones that can hardly wait to find someone that will agree with them as to what a jerk their husband is. And it's bad enough when females have the female furies. I'll tell you what's bad. I'll tell you what's the biggest abomination of all. It's when a man made in the image and likeness of God, actually the reincarnation of Jesus Christ on this earth as we are his children, for a man to have the three terrible female spirits is an abomination. And there's no way that woman's going to get out of it as long as you're in it, fury. And you romp and you stomp and you do and you say and you make accusations, and I get messages through third parties. I'm telling you right now, I'm not afraid of you. Stand up like a man and tell me to my face. I'll speak with you. Don't give me that three furies routine. They're terrible female spirits with snake-like hair. Serpents. Subtle. Behind the scenes. Slithering around. No man-like qualities whatsoever. So you see this, when you get to the point where you're actually doing some things, you are actually doing a fit of violence against your own body. You go out and get drunk. That's a fit of violence against your own body. You smoke a cigarette and inviting emphysema and cancer. That's a fit of violence against your own body. And you have all these fits of violence against yourself. And then along comes your innocent child doing something in memory of their dad or mom. And doing something that's equally violent to themselves. And what do? You beat the hell out of them. All of a sudden, you get so caught up in discipline and what's right. And the children don't understand what's going on. They don't understand why you're treating them that way. And neither does your wife, by the way. And wives, your children don't know why you're doing it. Because you're all caught up in the furies. Because you're all emotional. You're all products of your environment, where you came from. It's the firstborn of Pharaoh. It's the passion of your kin. You're acting just like them. Now, once you get to the fury part, there's only one left. And you'll recognize this one because everybody goes through it. The last part of emotion is hate. Remember, it started with love. You just love to love them. Before it's over, you'll love to hate them. Hate means, now you're doing a fit of violence now, understand this. You're doing things to hurt one another. The next thing that comes is hate. Hate means to loathe and despise and to have a strong ill will for. And I'm here to tell you, that's you hate your children, you hate your wife, you hate your husband. You have a strong loathing and despising and ill will for the very people in your own family. And you'll say, how dare you say that? How do you know? I'll tell you how I know. I know the rest of the definition of the word hate. It means a wish to avoid. You don't want to talk about it. You don't want to do anything about it. Hate also means to shrink from. You find every excuse to be everywhere but where you ought to be. Every conceivable reason that can come up to cause you and allow you to shrink from your responsibility. Why? Because you hate. Let me tell you something right now. Whatever you're shrinking from, whatever you shy away from, whatever you wish to avoid, that's what you hate. If you don't like it, get yourself a cheap dictionary. It'll tell you the same thing. And if you're too cheap to do that, call me. I'll tell you for free. You're trying to avoid, and that that you're avoiding, you hate. You loathe and despise the very...